Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Tom Pierre. I'm the chair of the Bodian Waterways Commission, and I hereby call to order this August 4th, 2026 commission meeting. This meeting is being held at Pier 40, the Embarcadero in San Francisco, California, as well as virtually on Zoom. Constituents who cannot be here in person can participate on Zoom. Instructions on how to participate virtually will be provided shortly. As a reminder to everyone, this meeting is live webcast and can be viewed at www.cal-span.org. The archived video will also be available at the cal-span.org website. Before we get started with today's agenda, please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance if you are able to do so. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, with liberty and justice for all. Next, I'd like to ask the clerk to call the roll.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Pierre. Chair Pierre is present. Jose Gonzalez.
Present.
Catherine Hawkins. Maggie Hallahan.
Present.
Gonzalo Medina. Not present. Hampitz Itzader.
Present.
Thank you. And Commissioner Rosales is not present. You have a quorum, okay, Chair Pierre.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. The clerk, I'm now going to ask if she can read the instructions regarding public comments on agenda and non-agenda items via Zoom.
Thank you. I will now provide some information on how the public participation will be organized for today's Bodian and Waterways Commission meeting. First, I will cover the in-person meeting protocols. To provide comments on agenda items in person, members of the public are requested to fill out the green public comment form located at the back of the room. To provide comments on non-agenda items in person, members of the public are requested to fill out the blue public comment form. Again, both comment forms are available at the sign-in table in the back. Once completed, please turn in your completed forms to myself. Each speaker will have 3 minutes to present their comments. Now I will cover procedures for using Zoom. If you wish to make verbal comment on one of the agenda items, or if you want to make a comment during the items not on the agenda comment period, you must use the Zoom webinar app or call in by phone. The Commission will hear public comments from in-person attendees first, and then we'll hear public comments from attendees on Zoom. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org but want to make public comments, you must first register for the Zoom webinar to receive your unique ID and password or a phone number if you wish to call. Information can be found on the notice, agenda, or at our website located at www.dbw.parks.ca.gov. To make public comments on agenda items, please virtually raise your hand at the beginning of the presentation to let us know you wish to speak. To do this, if you are using a computer or tablet, use the raise hand button in the Zoom webinar app, or if you are calling in by phone, dial *9 to raise your hand. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. It appears we do not have any dignitaries here today, either in person or virtually, unless nothing heard and no hands raised, presumably. None. Okay, well, I guess we don't make the cut for VIPs today. Now I'd like to introduce State Parks DBW staff. There's Liz McGurick, Ramona, and she is the Chief Deputy Director of California State Parks and Recreation. Ramona Fernandez, who of course is our esteemed Deputy Director of the Division of Boating and Waterways. And then our learned counsel, Catherine Tobias, Senior Legal Counsel to the California State Parks and Recreation. So welcome to everyone. So this is a little unusual, but as part of my discussion, I would like to finalize an issue that was brought up at our May meeting from Commissioner Hallahan. And this regards the fuel dock here in San Francisco Bay, which we, as part of our tour for those who are able to attend, regards the fuel docks right there on the East Harbor in San Francisco. The division has responded to Commissioner Hallahan's concerns. And at this time, I'd like to ask if there's any additional questions from the commission regarding the division's response. Do you have any further questions, Commissioner Hallahan?
Thank you, Chair Peer. We did receive, all the commissioners received a formal letter from the deputy director and legal counsel. It was a couple pages long, and all the questions that I had asked at the last meeting were addressed. They referred that there is no oversight with DBW for keeping maritime fuel accessible for recreational boating or emergency response, but they referred other agencies, which I did do that research, and there seems to be a gap in oversight to maintain adequate fuel and emergency response docks in California. So yes, they did answer in a written form, and that could be available. I asked Deputy Director Ramona Fernandez if this was a public document that it could release to the public, and she said yes, and I did send it out to some of the people that were asking about this in the San Francisco Bay, like the Harbor Safety Committee for San Francisco Bay Region. I sent it to their chair and to the research committees. So I think it was really helpful to keep gathering data, and we added that to the ad hoc with Harbor Safety Committee. Thank you, Chair.
And thank you, Commissioner Hallahan, for all the effort you put into this, because I do think it's a very important issue. Is there any other commissioners that would like to speak on this, on the fuel dock issue? I'll just kind of ramble on then as part of my general comments. First of all, I'd like to welcome everyone to San Francisco, my hometown, and for people who traveled to get here, additional appreciation for you going through that. The second thing I would like to do is I would like to thank staff for putting together what I felt was a very comprehensive and informative tour of many of the sites of contention and otherwise here in San Francisco, and then additionally in the of some of the issues facing Richardson Bay. And so I found it to be very informative, even though I was already mostly informed on the issues. I thought it was a very well coordinated, if not a little rushed, just because of time constraints, tour. So I want to say thanks for that. Thirdly, I'm sure most are aware, if not all, that we had this tragic sinking of a vessel in San Francisco Harbor, really pretty close to Alcatraz. Certainly within eyesight of where I live, I think it was about a mile offshore. And sort of the ongoing count is that Three people are confirmed dead, and one person is missing. And it's highly unusual to have a vessel sinking, especially of that size. I think it was 48 feet. And it was a well-founded vessel. The initial news reports seemed to indicate that it was a pontoon boat, but it wasn't. It was a cabin cruiser, three stories, a total of 20 people on board. Unfortunately, 16 of them were rescued. And one of the deceased actually made it to shore. He was elderly. And so they were unable to, I think he was just overstressed by being in the water and so forth. But I will just also note that a lot of the emergency response was coordinated out of the fuel dock that Commissioner Hallahan has been working very hard to maintain. And that dives into a lot of issues that aren't really the purview of this commission or the division, relating to San Francisco parks and recs and so forth and so on. And like I said, I don't want to delve into the detail, but I did want to add that, you know, sort of the mantra here for safety is always wear a life jacket. And I think what this incident, and to some degree, demonstrated is that it's not always practicable to save the lives just by wearing a life jacket. And like I said, this is a well-founded 48-foot boat, and people should always wear a life jacket, but sometimes it's just not practicable. And in this instance, it seems that three of the deceased were trapped inside the cabin when the vessel capsized. And so I think maybe the real takeaway here, and again, I have to compliment the division for the California Boaters Card, because I think this really sort of, well, let me say this. I think accidents happen, and they're not always avoidable. But having an educated public through the boating California Boaters Card, I think, goes a long way to helping avoid these kinds of tragedies. So that said, I'd like to just have a brief moment of silence in recognition of those who perished. Okay, thank you. So now I'll turn to my fellow commissioners for their various updates and activities. So, well, actually, prior to doing that, I would like to welcome Commissioner Gonzalez and let the clerk please reflect that he has joined the meeting.
Thank you, Chair Pierre. We now reflect that Gonzalo Medina, Commissioner, has joined us. Thank you.
Welcome, Commissioner Medina. Okay, so let's start it down at the end of the table. Commissioner Hallahan, do you have a report?
I defer to Commissioner Isdater to go first, and then I'll go.
Okay. Commissioner Isdater.
Thank you, Chair Pierre. Since our last meeting, I have been busy on many fronts and many different topics to do with boating and waterways here in California. I want to first of all share with you a couple of observations that concern the technological progress around boating here in California. I had the opportunity to engage with AltaSea, which some of you may know is the Blue Economy Center down at the Port of Los Angeles. They also have a startup incubator called Braid Theory, and I had the privilege of spending time with them as well and getting to meet many of the excellent startups that they incubate that are developing technology that has direct applications to boating. And I found it really interesting to see just how advanced some of these startups are. And I had the opportunity to trial an electric wake boat, something I had never experienced before. And it turned out to be an excellent experience. The technology is in many ways just as advanced as an electric vehicle on the road. And I think the biggest bottleneck that we identified as we walked through their value chain and all of the different needs of these electric boats is the charging infrastructure. For those of you who live in urban areas, you know that California has made a lot of progress in developing its electric vehicle charging infrastructure. However, when it comes to electric charging of boats, there are very few so-called superchargers out there. And that is something I think we should spend more time on, right? To understand how can we support this nascent industry, especially as many of these boats are produced right here in California. In fact, the boat that I got to trial is produced down in Torrance in Los Angeles County. So that it's been really interesting just seeing that whole side of boating in California and what boating may look like in the future. In addition to that, I've been traveling to some other states to see if there are lessons that we can learn for boating and boating infrastructure in California. Most recently, I was in Chicago, as recently as last week, visiting the Chicago harbors where they have 5,000 boat slips. And I think there are a lot of lessons we can learn from a large metro area like Chicago, and they probably pertain more so to cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, where we have high population density. We want the harbors to and boating to connect with a wider cross section of the population, and that's something I think they've done very well in the case of the Chicago harbors. That is my report. Back to you, Chair Pierre.
Thank you, Commissioner Idsater. I'm just going to make a very brief note that the California Air Resources Board has mandated that all ferries that operate within state waters become electrified. And I don't remember what the deadline for that is, but that's going to prove, there's a lot of ferry activity here in San Francisco Bay Area. Southern California, Newport Beach, up in the Delta, there's ferries that operate there. So that's just, pursuant to your comments. So that said, Commissioner Hallahan, would you like to proceed?
Yes, thank you so much. I want to say thank you to, good morning, everyone, to the DBW staff and everyone for putting the tour together yesterday. I know it was short notice and you made incredible, gallant work at covering the northern shore of San Francisco all the way down to South Beach here. And it's actually a lot of territory, including we went to Sausalito where the boat crushing is, which I know intimately. Actually, our Sea Scouts have used that 2 years ago to get two boats crushed by, utilizing these different agencies. So it works very efficiently. So thank you for putting that tour together. They also put on the tour the San Francisco Sea Scout Base, which I'm a leader at the Sea Scout Base and a boat captain. So I was able to invite over some of the people that come and tour at the dock at the Sea Scout Base. And one of them is the San Francisco Police Department Maritime Unit, Sergeant Bushnell, who was able to speak in our classroom for a little bit. And it was really great to have him have an opportunity to speak about their capabilities and their needs, because it's a very serious business. San Francisco Bay is a very serious business. It's one of the largest openings in deltas and waterways. It's hundreds and hundreds of miles to protect from many different things, as you know, invasive species, all kinds of criminal activities, and just people being careless on the water. It's just a very serious place. And so it's been a great honor of mine to grow up there, getting on the water from what's called Gas House Cove, or the East Harbor is what San Francisco Maritime likes to call it. And it is, the property is managed by San Francisco Rec and Park. So we were able to go over there for a quick view of the remediation area. And there was a lot put together really fast. I just want to share a couple inconsistencies that I was hearing. And I know there wasn't enough time to really go into it. And, you know, possibly the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee will be able to take this on with their deeper research, because they are local. And the Office of Emergency Services says that this is a local matter, as so does DBW when we were in our last meeting. So I understand that. I understand that. Though I think it's an implication of a gap that is throughout the state that is very serious. And so some of the inconsistencies I heard were SFPD Sergeant Maritime Sergeant Bushnell said that he uses that fuel dock for fueling and also for emergency response for, and also previously he had been in the Coast Guard. So he'd been using that dock for well over 10 years and had never had a problem with the actual depth of the submerged land. So at low tide, it's 8.5 feet. And as you know, with our other research, most boats are about 5 feet or less with draft. So even the bar pilot boat that's 66 feet long that goes in there to fuel up can go in at low tide. So the inconsistency I heard from Kelly Rudnick from SFRP is that the channel needed to be dredged. So that's the reason that it can't, that fuel dock can't stay there. But we don't have, a DBW doesn't have any regulations saying a particular depth or width for an entrance into a channel. So I saw that as being an inconsistency. And then I also, I heard from the Sea Scouts, which are very concerned that there's a Laguna outfall in that area, which, you know, does put raw sewage mixed with stormwater directly into that shallow water basin. And the youth have a lot of questions about water standards. And that brings up a topic that we've talked about here before at DBW, is that we give grants for non-motorized boats to have slips, but we're not asking for consistent Rec 1 water testing. So the water board, the California Water Board, just puts guidelines out. And so the guideline is Rec 1 is stand-up board, kayaking, and swimming. And Rec 2 is small boats, 4 to 5 people, then larger. So if that shallow water basin area is being suggested by SFRP, San Francisco Rec and Park, to be used as a shallow water basin, non-motorized kayaking stand-up board area, but at the same time, the inconsistency is they're saying there'll be no swimming and no touching the water in that shallow water basin. Now, we don't have any guidance over that now, but it is potential that in our upcoming any kind of grants that we give, that we make sure that if it's non-motorized vessel, that it's been looked into, that it's Rec 1 water quality. It's very serious. I mean, this is, I've been teaching for 35 years there. This is, I've got second generation youth in my life, and they're very concerned. And we are swimming in aquatic park, which is fantastic. And that does get tested twice a week. So these are some of the inconsistencies. Also, they, Scott Grindy, the harbor master, said that they're for lack of a better word, they're calling something a community dock, but it's not going to be a community dock. It's going to be a paid overnight dock for 24-hour visitation. A community dock is where you can do touch and go, which this youth at the Sea Scouts were clear that for 8 years, we haven't been able to touch or go at the entire marina. SFRP has not allowed any boats that are not paying for a slip and not a member of the two yacht clubs to touch any dock and unload or load people. And we loaned money to West Harbor. I mean, they're still paying us back, this department, DBW. Can we put in, anytime we're loaning money, to make sure that there's public access for loading and unloading with our agreements in the future when we make loans, to just make sure that the public access is real and not... So in that letter we got from the harbor master, Grindy, it said that we could go and pump out at the fuel dock, I mean, at the pump out station that DBW built, but we couldn't load or unload anyone at that. And then he also asked me to go to DBW and ask for dredging for that area. And we don't do dredging. So anyway, I wanted to just finish with a one slide from... we have created a very light survey for a subcommittee ad hoc group that we're doing. Commissioner Stoddard and I.
Excuse me,
yeah.
Commissioner Hallahan, is this, I think this is, well, I think.
I got this okayed by Ramona.
Okay.
And she put the slide through.
Very well. Okay.
So in the last meeting, we weren't able to do this because we had to change something in the type. So we've now changed it to subcommittee survey, and that was what was asked, and we did it. And now this is the next meeting, and we're putting this forward. So thank you so much. If anyone is watching this or interested, you can scan this, and it's a 12-question survey, and it's very light survey about boating slips and boat access. And feel free to put your comments in there, and everything will be read. This is a very small, non-funded survey that we're using for our hypothesis in a ad hoc development that we're doing. So I appreciate everyone's time. I really appreciate yesterday. Thank you so much, everyone. And that's it. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for that report, Commissioner Hallahan. And I commend both you and Commissioner Idsotter for all the work you've put into the survey. Moving on, Commissioner Gonzalez, do you have a report for us this morning?
Yeah, I'll be brief and comment on the site tour yesterday as well. First, appreciation to staff, as always. You know, all the work and logistical wrangling that it takes to get the commission throughout the day. So just want to make that very clear and note that. We're also joined by State Parks peace officers that, and they're here out and about. So that's always a, just as a nice reminder, but kind of seeing how all the coordination that happens with staff, the two pieces as well is, I've always appreciated how a lot of the work that the division and the commission kind of, touch on is tends to be site visits out in rural California, and the very clear and high need for what the work that the division does is out there just because of lack of access and so forth. And also how yesterday, Commissioner Pierre welcoming us to San Francisco, you know, urban environments have their needs too. And even though the Bay Area, of course, is a place with a lot of resources and there's, you know, it has its own stratification of income inequality, it's always helpful to still see how the division's role in what they can provide has these opportunities for public access in a such an urbanized place as this. So I want to note on that, because I think as also my observations yesterday were, you get to a place like this, and when you look at all of the overlapping or touching jurisdictions, responsibilities, specific statutory authorities, as well as regulatory, and I think always trying to look and find and identify where the division and, of course, the commission as well touch on some of those and where they don't. Commissioner Pierre, I'll blame you for this habit that I now have to always look for the this was funded by the Division of Voting and Waterways, which is nice. I just, like, you know, I think it's a nice little visual appreciation for that. So just thinking of yesterday, being able to see in terms of the SAFE program and where the actual tearing of the boats happening, and that's a joint powers authority. And we were with city and county jurisdiction with their parks. We, you know, San Francisco Port Authority is its own. And so it's just been an appreciation of how that overlays in as well. And Commissioner Hallahan, also appreciated hearing from the youth as always. You know, as a former or current educator, it's always a treat to kind of see youth being able to engage in the public process in that way as well. So that's all I have for now.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Gonzalez. And now I will recognize Commissioner Medina. Do you have anything to report?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I just want to echo the thanks to the staff for all their great work. Special shout out to Courtney for all her coordination and getting her flights together and being responsive at a minute's notice. And also, what a great opportunity to see out that site yesterday and with respect to the crushing of the vessels and being able to be a part of that SAVE program and their focus on conservation and the environment, but also addressing these challenges that we have up and down the state with derelict vessels and vessels that just need to be removing out of the water. So what a great model, great partnership, and I think that's a great example for other areas to do to the best that they can. It was great to see SFPD, and it was great to see the Port of San Francisco future thinking about the needs of SFPD as they make upgrades to their marina. I was pleased to hear that they're going to be able to provide fuel access for emergency response, both fire and PD with respect to diesel and unleaded. So that was great to hear. Great on the SFPD and the Port of San Francisco on that partnership. And with respect to Long Beach, a lot of planning, deep in planning for Olympics and our impacts to our waterways access, how that's going to impact the recreational community, the movement of liveaboards from permanent marinas to other marinas. So huge impacts there, working with agencies within the Olympics, especially with respect to water testing and quality. There's new technology, portable, with very quick results that is being worked through right now. It was used in the Paris Olympics, and they're looking to utilize it here in LA 28. Portable needs to work through some clearances with our health department and the state, but that would be great for areas like San Francisco that need quick quality water results fast, and it does it immediately, portable, and this is good technology being brought over from Europe. So, but with that, that concludes my comments, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And then finally, last but not least, Commissioner Hawkins, do you have a report?
Yeah, thank you. I just want to again echo the comments of the commission on the staff and their support. It is a lot of work to organize these tours and meetings, so thank you for everything. I'll start at just commissioner report from our last meeting. I've been busy advocating at the state capitol, working on budgets, and really elevating the voices of the boating community so that we are protecting jobs and staffing at some key agencies, most of the agencies that are represented in this room right now. So again, just underscoring the importance of the collaboration and partnership that happens between state agencies and the local jurisdiction, which is huge. So again, I applaud the staff for all their work. Again, we have some tight budgets this year, but we are making the most of it to ensure that the boating community feels safe and welcomed into California waterways. So thank you. Lastly, I'll just kind of dig in as far as representing rural communities in the Sierra Nevada. Because of the great weather we've had, we've had moderate wildfires, knock on wood. We've been hosting and welcoming millions of people from all over the world into our rural communities. And so again, just the work that we're doing here about education, safety, life jackets, again, the boater cards, all that work has ripple effects in every corner of the state. So again, just applaud the efforts of the staff and look forward to a great meeting. So thank you.
Please, Commissioner Gonzalez.
Super quick, as Commissioner Hawkins was speaking, it reminded me of something I completely forgot. At our last I believe it was the last meeting, we had the Deputy Secretary for Access, Natural Resources, come and share about the Outdoors for All work that is happening. At that meeting, we got kind of a hint of a preview of some convenings that may be coming up. So just want to share publicly here that those are scheduled now. I believe they're at the Resources Agency site, as well as you can reach out to some of the fellow commissioners who know what sort of information is, and that is a that's a information gathering kind of process throughout the state, seven of them to kind of really mapped out throughout the state and opportunities to Outdoors for All. But of course, key element of that is what is access in terms of our waterways.
Very good. Thank you. And then I would just like to thank all of my fellow commissioners for all of the hard work that you all put into representing the boating committee, the boating community. It's kind of sometimes feels like, thankless work, but I commend everyone for volunteering their, well, we do get a per diem, so that doesn't really add up too much. But anyways, thank you all for putting on in all the time you put in. So, okay, so that said, we're going to move on to the next agenda item, which is item six, which is for public comments on items not on the agenda. And I don't know, do we have any cards, Madam Clerk?
Thank you, Commissioner Pierre. We don't have any hands raised online, and we don't have any blue comment cards in person.
Okay. Okay. Well, that said, we'll just move on to the next agenda item. And I'm going to formally close public comments for items not on the agenda. So now we will hear from, we'll now hear recognize item number seven, and this would be the Deputy Director's report. And I'd like to turn it over to Deputy Director Fernandez.
Thank you, Chair Pierre. And again, I do want to thank the commission for yesterday's tour, especially the two commissioners that are, this is your hometown. Appreciated the welcoming and additional information on boating access and challenges here in the city. Next slide, please. So we do have some new team members at the division, so I want to recognize them. So I'll start out with Davy Alvarez, who joins us. He's actually here today. She is the division's she's my administrative assistant, but more importantly, she also serves as the new commission clerk. So she joins the division from the private sector, where she has experience in customer service and has served in restaurant hospitality. She brings in a new perspective to the role of the commission as the commission clerk, where she will work alongside myself and other team members. We look forward to her, continuing on working with you. She's a graduate of Sacramento State and majoring in communications, and she will be the point of contact for you all moving forward. Our next team member from the administrative services, Eleanor Kania. She joins the division in our administrative services. She will serve as the aquatic invasive species contracts procurement support as an analyst too. Eleanor spends the last year with the Department of Food and Ag, where she was responsible for auditing various accounting systems, operations, programs, and internal control structures. She achieved her bachelor's and master's of accountancy from Jessup University. Eleanor has a passion for state parks and the outdoor recreation. Other new team members, next slide, please, is Anna Prisbaugh, who is a park and rec specialist in our grants and loans unit. So Anna joins us as the Aquatic Center Grant Program Manager. She earned her history's bachelor's degree at UCLA with a minor in art history. Anna comes from within parks, where she was a guide for the Capital District for the last 2 years. There, she led and developed interpretive tours for state parks and implemented a junior ranger program. Anna loves the water. She spends many summers boating at the Sacramento State Aquatic Center and also enjoys kayaking on Lake Tahoe, whitewater rafting, and volunteering as a docent at local museums. We also have, next slide, please, a few other team members in our aquatic invasive species unit. Maxwell Little returned to the division as aquatic pest control technician. We're happy to have him back on the crew and back to the division. He previously served with the division in our aquatic invasive species unit and brings his wealth and knowledge and experience back to the team. Also, we have Matthew, Shelby, and Rachel, who also joined the aquatic invasive species team as environmental services interns. Matthew grew up exploring the outdoors, and his favorite things to do include hiking, running, kayaking, sailing, camping, fishing, and waterfowl hunting. He enjoys nature and wildlife photography, especially birds and landscape scenes. A little bit about Shelby. She recently graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Studies and has enjoyed work that gets her outdoors and connected to California's natural resources. She also works as a lifeguard too at Folsom State Recreational Area, where she has gained experience in public safety, teamwork, and spending long days and around the water. Rachel graduated with a BA in Environmental Studies. She has prior experience as a scientific aide for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. She has worked on the California Recreational Fisheries and Central Valley Angler Surveys, interviewing anglers and collecting biological data on species, as well as conducting angler surveys by boat and collecting biological data on fish species throughout the Sacramento River. And Dr. Charles Hong joins DBW in a temporary assignment as a staff toxicologist. The doctor has a wide background variety and various ecological folks that makes him a great fit for our division. He's evaluating ecological risk assessments on the toxic effects of chemical contaminants on fish, wildlife, biodiversity, and other habitats, and recommended solutions to minimize risk to those resources in terrestrial, freshwater, estuarine, and marine environments. We welcome all of our new team members to the division. Next slide, please. As I report every year, this is the most updated state DMV vessel registration numbers. We have increased from the prior report out in February. So we're at about 530,000 registered boaters. This tends to go up depending on the year as registration. This will be a new, this year will be the renewal for boat registrations. So we will see this number increase. Our average is about 630,000 that we've been seeing. Next slide, please. A little update on our regulations. So as a result of AB 865, we continue to work through our internal process to propose amendments to California Regulation Code 14, Section 7606, which is the Fees for the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act. The proposed fee schedule will be incorporated into regulations at the regulations, California Code of Regulations, and is intended to reflect and recover program costs and reduce strain on the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. So just a few sections that will be revised when we go through that rulemaking process is Section 736C of the Harbors and Watercraft Navigation Code, which establishes specified fee amounts required under this act, which remain in effect until the division adopts regulations pursuant to this new law. Section 736 authorized the division to adopt regulations setting forth the fees to be charged and collected under the act and requires that those fees be sufficient to reimburse the division for the reasonably costs of implementing the act. And consistent with the statutory framework and pursuant to AB 865, the legislature authorized the division to set and adjust fees through the normal rulemaking process, rather than relying on statutory gaps in order to ensure that the division is adequately reimbursed for its actual reasonable implementation costs. We will continue to update you on the progress of updating our regulations and the new fee increases for the yacht brokers and salespersons. Also, AB 149 provides critical funding and regulatory tools to curb the golden mussel's rapid invasive, building on a statewide golden mussel response framework launched in 2025. Prevention via the clean drain and drive for boats remains key, and AB 849 required the divisions to implement emergency regs to have clear departmental review and will be sent to the Office of Administrative Law soon. A new fee structure will also be announced soon as a result of AB 149. And we'll continue to update you on the progress as we move forward with AB 149. And next slide, please. And on that same subject, just wanted to continue with informing you on what the division's responsibility has been in terms of the mussel infestation prevention grant program and the golden mussel, particularly with the golden mussel. So the division continues to be the lead outreach and education on the golden mussel response efforts. Pictured on the screen are examples of our joint departmental efforts and recently updated outreach material that include the golden mussel. These are printed in English as well as Spanish to broaden the public reach. We've also fulfilled a significant uptick of requests for rat cards and signs to educate the public on how to prevent invasive mussel spread and the public outreach materials that help identify infested waters. Requesters have included the public, water managers, and other state agencies. We also are working with a communications contractor, which is our uncommon contractor, to develop radio and social media outreach campaigns, educating the public on how they can do their part to prevent invasive mussel spread. Requests for education and outreach material may be made to the email noted on this slide. Next slide, please. California Boater Card. As you all are aware, end of January of 2025, we are now in full implementation of this program. To date, we have issued 525,000 cards. We currently have 21 course providers that meet the education requirement for the public to be able to get their boater cards. And next slide, please. So boating statistics. So reporting for our calendar year 26, obviously we're still in 26, has not concluded. So listed on the graph that you see are for our completion of our 25 in the last 5 years. The statistics have been reported to the division and the numbers are subject to change once our final period is concluded for 2026. So for comparison, in 25, there were 40 fatalities, 180 injuries, and 442 accidents. In total, in comparison from 25 to current statistics this year, based on the accidents that have been reported to the division, as of July of 2026, there have been 12 boating fatalities, 67 injuries, and 148 accidents. And just a note there, as Chair Peer mentioned earlier, in July, there was an incident here in the San Francisco Bay that had 4 fatalities. In comparison with 25, as of July of 2025, there were 34 boat fatalities and 114 injuries in this same reporting period. Also noted, in 2025, in June, there was that incident in Lake Tahoe where El Dorado County led, where there were 8 fatalities. For our 2026 statistics that have been reported to the division, fatalities by boat type, their cabin motorboats have been 5, kayaks, paddlecraft have been 3, and one each open for one of each type of open motorboat, personal watercraft, pontoon, and canoe paddlecraft, for a total of 4 so far in 2026. Of the fatalities that have been reported in 2026 to the division, 6 of those were not wearing a PFD. 3 were not ascertained if they were wearing one or not, so they couldn't determine. And 3 had been wearing a life jacket. So again, what Chair Peer had mentioned about life jacket wear, we do emphasize the importance of it, but sometimes even with the life jacket, there's fatalities. Next slide, please. So this year, the division, California, was chosen as a host state to heighten Operation Dry Water awareness on a national level. The division coordinated a 2-day Operation Dry Water initiative on the Colorado River, featuring a national media kickoff and a public outreach event. Recognizing the lasting change requires a unified approach, the division brought together federal, state, and local partners, including ourselves, California State Parks, the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the National Park Service, Arizona Game and Fish Department, Nevada Department of Wildlife, San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, Riverside Police Department, and the Riverside County Sheriff's Department, and other regional boating safety and law enforcement agencies. Together, these organizations delivered one clear and powerful message: boating under the influence is driving under the influence. By presenting a unified front, the event strengthened coordination among participating agencies and created a consistent messaging across the region. This collective approach helped generate sufficient media attention leading into the heightened enforcement weekend, which was the week, the week prior to the 4th of July weekend. The event also provided broadcast, print, and digital media outlets with strong visual contents, access to multimedia subject matter experts, and relevant boating safety data. These opportunities expanded the campaign, earned media reach, and reinforced the importance of sober boating throughout the Colorado region. I would like to recognize Melissa Miranda, our boating education manager, and her team for really putting this whole venue together. There was a lot of us that were participants, but her team managed the logistics, and it was challenging with so many agencies involved and in another state. Next slide, please. Another event on that same subject of boating safety and recognizing the importance of boating under the influence. The division also participated in the 2026, which is called River Blitz, in the Sacramento, and which Sacramento and Yolo Sheriff's Departments and Sacramento Police Departments on the Sacramento River on July 25th, hosted by Sacramento County Sheriff's, Sacramento Police Department, and Yolo County Sheriff's. The River Blitz brought together multiple agencies, assisted in patrolling and educating the public on boating safety. Participants between agencies provided over 30 vessels on the water, patrol vessels, vehicles on land, and one helicopter in the air. Vessels were dispatched evenly throughout the Sacramento River within the assigned jurisdictions. I had the opportunity to speak at that important event on the continuing build on partnership and training and the California Boating Safety with the California Boating Officers Association, who also spoke about upcoming opportunities for training and some legislative changes. Other agencies and organizations that participated were Mothers Against Drunk Driver, who supported the law enforcement efforts against boating under the influence by placing a local Mad Buoy to raise awareness of the dangers of boating while under the influence. Additional River Blitz efforts are scheduled throughout the state to heighten awareness on boating safety. Next slide, please. So stakeholder engagements on the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund stability continues as required by AB 102. To date, the division has held two stakeholder engagement meetings. Overall, we've had a positive turnout with various groups, organizations, and members of the public attending our public meetings. We recapped on summarized past engagement efforts, provided an overall of the Harbors and Watercraft Evolving Fund, the budget cycle, and key efforts by the division. The division staff also provided an overall and details on the budget change proposal process, its timelines, and clear information on its development. More importantly, these engagements allowed the public to provide input, concerns, additional recommendations that will inform the BCP process that will be part of the 27-28 governor's budget. Themes that we heard from the engagement process included impacts to the harbors and watercraft due to transfers to other beneficiaries and suggestions for statute changes, requests for change to statutes that obligates the Harbors and Watercraft Evolving Fund and division for efforts like beach erosion, coastal settlement, non-motorized participation, as well as sediment that registered recreational boaters are bearing the brunt of financial responsibilities, effects of current division financial reductions to programs on marine law enforcement patrol training and impact to safety responses on the water, aquatic invasive species efforts and the need for cost-sharing beneficiaries, vessel registration discussion on restructuring the vessel registration, something other than a flat fee, financial impact to the vessel registration increases to recreational boaters, requests for a one-stop shop for all things recreational boating related, and other great discussions and information was heard, in addition to frustration concerns on the state's process of developing a budget change proposal. The division continues assessing all the information and will communicate through regular channels if a final meeting will take place. We aim to maintain open lines of communication and will continue to listen to the boating stakeholders. We have heard your concerns, ideas, and frustrations. We are considering all the information that we have heard from these and past engagement meetings to populate the development of the Harbors and Watercraft Evolving Fund Sustainability Budget Change Proposal. Next slide, please. And final remarks, I just want to inform the commission that once again, we will be coordinating the November commission meeting with the annual Marine Recreation Association Conference. This year, it will be held in Newport Beach at the Balboa Bay Resort. Once we have finalized logistics with MRA, Daisy will be reaching out to you for your travel arrangements. We will not have a tour meeting. We will not have a tour. We'll just have the meeting in part, and it will be again in part of the MRA conference agenda. So you all will have an opportunity to participate in the conference, the MRA conference. And that concludes my report, Chair Pierre.
Thank you very much, Deputy Director, for your report. I believe now we're going to have public comments on the report.
Thank you, Chair Pierre. Yeah. We have no green comment cards, and I see no hand raised online.
Okay. Well, in that event, I will turn to my commissioners, fellow commissioners. Does anyone have any questions for the Deputy Director? Commissioner Hallahan.
Thank you for that report. Many of us came online for the community meetings that you're holding around the fund. And I have a couple quick questions about it. Could we, I know we recorded the meetings. Is it possible, because in the last meeting, people didn't really know what happened in the first meeting, and now we've had two meetings. I think it'd be really pretty amazing to have the transcript of the audio of that written and in a PDF and have that sent out, because you're extracting all the information from that. So it might be like a 20-page PDF, but it could be attached to the email that you're sending out, because I know it's really hard to put stuff online. But that data of everyone communicating is really important, and I just would like to see it more in the public for what your next agenda is for the third meeting, you know, to round it up. It would just be great to not have it filtered by anybody, you know, because there were a lot of good comments, and people who want to come on the third meeting should hear about those. And I'm glad you're doing that. It's important. So around the registration part of that dialogue, one of the things that I've been hearing for the last year from some of the people we've been interviewing is to charge for boat vessel registration by the value of the boat. And people have said that quite a bit in the meeting. And I just think it's really important to make sure that really expensive boats that might not be very long are paying a good amount. And people have been saying that. I don't know how that would work out, but we hear it from people all the time. And I'm not in favor of non-motorized vessels being charged. I think that it will be a huge mess and a lot of energy. And they were using the Oregon standards of it, but it actually, in the last 4 years, they haven't figured out in Oregon if they're making any money, if the enforcement is costing more than the actual non-motorized vessels. So I really think we should have a study and really look at the Oregon model before just like running it out there in the meeting, because there's some good stats from the non-motorized taxation. And I really think there'd be a huge pushback if we did that in the state. So the other is that the boat registration went down pretty significant. We'll make sure that we add that in our what we're doing with our ad hoc. Do you think this is the low year or the high year with those statistics? Because like last year it was like 640 and this year is 5-something.
Yeah, so the next registration cycle will start actually the end of this year. So this will be our quote unquote high year, but it's not realized till really the prior year. So I think this is, I would consider the lower year, just in terms of registration, because I think as we monitor and as DMV provides that information, we normally, comparing it to prior years, we normally get to that 630 amount. It seems like it's the number that we eventually get to, because as you notice, I think in April when we, or February when we reported, it was like 400 and I can't remember, 450 or something like that. So it does increase through the months, and depending on when DMV report, you know, reports it to us.
But it's still a steady slide down.
It's, I would say we're pretty much at about 630. So, and we have been there about the last year or so.
Okay. Yeah. And do you get stats? I know you get the stats, but from the U.S. Coast Guard registered vessel number in California, we get money from the U.S. Coast Guard for the, we don't get any funds.
We don't get any funds from the federal.
Okay. And do we have a sum of that every year that we're getting from the Coast Guard of what those numbers are?
So no, we are working with the Coast Guard to get more consistent reports from them on number of documented. I think the last number that was provided to us was 280 something.
280.
Yeah, so it was about 208. No, it might have been about 300,000.
Oh, 300,000.
300, I think.
In California.
In California. But
wow, that's a big number.
Approximate. I can get that number.
Yeah, let's work on that because it's something we could use in our report that we're working on. I really would appreciate that. And then the final question is.
Only 30? Oh, I'm sorry. 30,000.
Yeah, I thought it was 30,000 too. Yeah.
Okay.
But let's get that number so we can add it in because we did it last year. And then finally, I would like to ask if there's been any progress with the economic impact of boating funds that we were hoping were coming through legislative.
So we are on the scope. We are finalizing that process now. We had to wait for the budget process to change to the new fiscal year in order to, I believe, start advertising. So I think we're anticipated maybe this fall to advertise that.
You're going to advertise the RFP?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And will we have another round to be looking at that finalized RFP before it goes out?
No, at this point, once we finalize it, then it'll, once it goes out.
Because we didn't really get a response back once we sent in our comments. And it'd be great to take another look at that. I'd really like to take another look before you put it out. And there does seem to be enough time. I know you might not be able to incorporate our comments, but I'd still like the opportunity to look at it.
Yeah. One of the challenges, though, is once it goes out to, I mean, once it becomes then the, right before the scope is making that a public process because of the ability to contract out. I think it gets a little dicey of the contracting process.
We had a lot of comments about the scope and how it was written. And so as mariners, we'd like to look at that. I'd like to look at that. If it's possible, just to read the scope of how you have it. Because, you know, I think it's important that we have who does the RFP be, you know, deeply into the maritime here. Maybe Cal Poly Maritime or, you know, some people that really are of this working waterfront instead of just Pacific work. So there's a lot of intricacies of how things have to be managed so that we have a working waterfront in California and we should incorporate that anyway. And also that there could possibly be a real survey happening after that, like the Department of Off-Road. California Parks has their off-road department and they have their own economic impact report and an excellent survey, may I say, on their website, and I could see that as our future. Thank you very much.
Any other commissioners with questions? Okay, nothing heard. I'm going to, I just had a couple of questions. Why is it under the purview of the division to hire a toxicologist? Just, I guess, to my way of thinking, that's more fish and game.
So in our treatment program in the Delta, it's as we work through types of treatment chemicals, maybe herbicides. So it's very specific on that program.
Now I understand. Okay, thank you. I'm going to echo Commissioner Hallahan's comments about vessel documentation because that's a fair number, and in some ways it's not fair that people who have federally documented vessels such as yours truly you know are not paying anything into the Boating and Waterways Revolving Fund. You also mentioned a new fee structure. I believe that was for invasive species. What is, because that sounds like a fee increase to me.
So, yes. So there will be a new fee increase for the mussel stick. Well, it used to be called the quagga and zebra mussel sticker. Now it will be called the mussel sticker, which will include golden mussel. Okay. And that fee for people that recreate in non-navigable waters will be required.
And is that set legislatively or?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Then finally, actually not finally, second to final, I'll just once again commend the work on the boating cards and can see that, you know, the number of cards issued almost equals the number of boat registrations, which is quite, outstanding work. And so, kudos to everyone who's worked on that program. And then finally, I just wanted to clarify, Stalin said, one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic. And by sort of focusing on these large casualty incidents of fatalities that I have a tendency to recognize, I certainly do not mean to overlook or overshadow all the other fatalities that happen individually in the boating community. So I just wanted just to kind of clarify my thoughts on that, because, it is a little, I guess we could have every commission meeting, we could say how many people died, in the last quarter. But so these major incidents seem to draw attention. But I don't mean to overshadow the other tragedies that seem to happen rather frequently. Okay, so moving on. We are now, let's see, we're doing well. How is everyone doing for not, I don't think we have that many more agenda items. Do people need a quick restroom break or just nothing heard? Okay, we'll just keep going. So now we're to agenda item number 9, and that is division program updates. So
budget.
Budget.
7.
Strike. Okay. Okay, I'm a little bit out of place here. Yep. Okay.
Chair Pierre, we're on item 8, budget report, and yep, we're waiting for the budget office to make that presentation.
Okay. Got it. Okay, so moving on to item number 8, we're going to hear from California State Parks Budget Manager Jason Leverenz about the budget report.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners, and to all in attendance. I'm Jason Leverenz, Assistant Budget Officer at California State Parks. Today, I'll provide an overview of the Division of Boating and Waterways enacted 2026-27 budget. I'll walk through the overall budget, recent expenditure trends, funding sources, revenue outlook, and briefly touch on the fiscal condition of the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. I'll begin with our overall budget for the new fiscal year. Next slide, please. So this slide represents the 2026-27 enacted budget. Key messages here, the division's total budget consists of approximately $53.4 million, split between $30 million in state operations and $23.4 million in local assistance. State operations supports the day-to-day administration of DBW programs and staffing. Local assistance funds grants that support boating infrastructure, boating safety, and local partners throughout California. Worth noting, there's very little variance from last year's budget. Breaking down the funding sources for state operations, we have $14.5 million from the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund, $7.8 million from federal trust funds, $6.7 million in reimbursements, and $1 million from the Vessel Operator Certification Account for the Boater Card Program. Grant programs, we have $2.3 million for boating facilities grants, $8.1 million for boating operations grants, $12 million for equipment and aquatic center grants, and $1 million for abandoned watercraft abatement. Budget changes, worth noting, position authority reflects a reduction of 6 positions due to the Department of Finance's government efficiency reduction mandate. That included statewide vacant position reductions and elimination requirements. 5 of the 6 positions that were swept were related to prior aquatic invasive species program funding reductions. Next slide, I'll show you how expenditures have changed over the last 3 fiscal years. This slide compares expenditures across the last 3 fiscal years and includes all appropriations under DBW. Worth noting is 2024-25 reflects actual expenditures, while the numbers for 2025 and 26 and 2026 and 27 reflect total appropriations. For state operations, total appropriations for both state operations and local assistance in 2025 and 26-27 reflect little variance and remain relatively stable operating level going forward. Local assistance expenditures have gradually declined over the last 3 years. This reflects reduced grant appropriations while continuing to support the core boating programs. And lastly, we have the Davis-Dahlwig transfer that remains consistently at $10 million annually as required by statute. Main takeaway is overall expenditures are stable, but available funding continues to be constrained. And we can move on to the next slide, please. This chart shows where local assistance funding comes from. We have federal funding authority to receive up to $12 million in federal funds annually. These federal funds continue to support the federally authorized boating programs. From the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund, local assistance has steadily declined as part of the broader efforts to improve the long-term sustainability of the fund. The other funding category represents Abandoned Watercraft Abatement Fund. The funding for that was reduced to $1 million beginning in 2025-26. Next, we can transition and we'll look at revenues that are specifically coming into the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. Next slide. Thank you. So this slide focuses only on revenues flowing into the HWRF. For revenue sources, broken down by category, we have registration fees and licenses in red, interest and investment income in light blue, and motor vehicle fuel account transfers from gasoline excise tax revenues in white. Important to note as well here, actual figures are shown for 2425. The 2526 and 2627 amounts are Department of Finance projections. Key observation is that while revenue sources remain relatively stable, they're not increasing at a rate enough to keep pace with the expenditures in the fund. That brings us to the division's overall fiscal outlook, and we can hop into the next slide. Main message here, this is the most important slide. This chart illustrates the relationship between annual HWRF revenues and expenditures and transfers that are coming into the fund. Expenditures are shown on the left, and revenues and transfers are shown on the right. To walk through, state operations remain relatively consistent throughout. Local assistance has been reduced over time. Other departments' costs continue to place demands on the fund. On the revenues and transfers side, HWRF revenues include registration revenues after required transfers. Historically, general fund transfers have helped bridge the gap in funding. But critical point is that the general fund transfers that we received, $20.7 million in both 2023-24, not pictured in 2024-25, that is pictured. Beginning in 2025-26, those transfers are no longer included. There have been additional transfers into the fund, however, not as major dollar amounts. 2025-26 includes a $6.3 million transfer from the Public Beach Restoration Fund. It's not included in the chart legend for some reason, but also a $3 million transfer from the Abandoned Watercraft Abatement Fund. And in 2026-27, an additional $900,000 transfer from the Abandoned Watercraft Abatement Fund. Basically breaking it down, like what it means, without the transfers, expenditures definitely exceed ongoing revenues. It really paints a picture that makes the structural imbalance a lot more apparent. And basically, without a registration fee increase or some sort of long-term funding solution, the HWRF is projected to become insolvent. And that wraps up that slide. And yeah, thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you for that presentation. Do we have any public comment on agenda item number 8?
Thank you, Chair Pierre. We have no green comment cards and we have no hand raised online.
Okay. In that event, I'll ask my fellow commissioners if they have questions. Commissioner Idstotler.
Thank you, Chair Pierre, and thank you for that excellent presentation. I had a quick question regarding the state operation expenditures. The trend line there looks interesting to me because you go from 19.5 million approximately in the fiscal year 2024-2025 to 31.2 million approximately in the last fiscal year that just concluded, and then it is projected or forecasted to decrease to $30 million in the upcoming fiscal year. Could you just explain that trend line? Since we're really looking at a historical increase of over 50%, followed by a slight decline, it'd be helpful to understand that a little bit better.
Yeah, of course. I hope I can answer that well. The large variance is basically 2024 and 25 are going to reflect actual expenditures. While you're looking at the numbers for 25 and 26 and 2026 and 27, those reflect total appropriations that we have received the budget for. However, that's not to say that they're going to be fully utilized.
Any other commissioners with questions? Nothing heard. I'm just have two. Slide 3 shows this, I guess it's $10 million to Davis Hallwig or Davis Dahlwig. What is that?
It's basically a it's a transfer that's required by mandate. I believe someone on the program side might be able to speak to this better, but I believe it's part of the California State Water Act. But that is that's law. And it's yeah, I could pull up the code. I just can't speak to it off the top of my head. But it's something that we're required by law to do annually.
Karen Dill would like to address the question.
Thank
Ms.
you.
Dill.
Hi, Karen Dill, Chief of Grants and Loans for the division. Davis Dahlwig, yes, is for the State Water Project, and it's to offset costs of recreation on those water bodies. So it retains access to the water bodies that are associated with the State Water Project
Okay.
for recreational boating.
Okay. All right, well, if it's mandated, it's mandated. But that's the answer that I won't get into the merits of that. So then the other question I had for you is from slide 5, which shows 3 years' revenues and transfers. And my question pertains to the fees and licensing components of those revenues and transfers. And I'm not understanding. Was 2025, 2026 an anomalous event that the fees and licenses went up so high, and now they're projected to go down very substantially from the current period we're in?
Chair Pierre, if I may, just because I believe I have asked this question in one of our prior meetings,
Okay.
I believe, and Jason, please correct me if I'm wrong, that it is because of the semi-annual nature of the boat registration fees and the revenue recognition, my personal opinion is that is something we may want to change, the revenue recognition policy being such that they only recognize the fees when received, right? They don't spread them over a two-year period as you could do under some other accounting policies.
Okay, I'm now recalling that conversation, and thank you for clarifying. Okay, so that said, I would like to thank you very much, Jason. Wait, I'm sorry. Yes, please.
Just a quick question, and maybe I missed it here somewhere, but with respect to FTEs for DBW, how many vacancies do we currently have within DBW, or how staffed is DBW?
Don't have that report in front of me, but I believe we have approximately 5 vacancies currently. Total PYs is maybe 53. I can get you the exact numbers, but it's around that 53, and I think we have about maybe 5 vacancies.
I see. Yeah. So like total 57 total FTEs then?
Yeah, approximate, sorry. But I'll get that number to you.
Okay. And it'd be good to see where they're broken, where they're spread across DBW with respect to their.
Primarily, the majority of our vacancies are an aquatic invasive plant control program.
Right. And then it'd be great to see also, not necessarily now, but at some point, just where all the FTEs are spread across the DBW with respect to assignments and responsibilities and duties as well, especially as we're looking into the future here.
We can provide you with an org chart. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Commissioner Gonzalez.
I'll make this as a comment, and if staff and other commissioners feel it's helpful. Because I think on the thinking about until, you know, something changes by statute or other need, there are going to be these kind of 4 to 5 constant reminders as to, and I say this, Chair, because I've asked in the past also about the Davis-Dahlberg transfers, like, what is that? Like, or remembering that we have that kind of every other year. So I don't know if there might be a way in when we include some of the budget or financial presentations where it's a slide of like, just as a reminder, these 4 things are going to be reflected. And again, I'm thinking right when we probably have new commissioners or just kind of those reminders of how those may come up.
Great. Anyone else? Okay, nothing heard. We'll move on to the next agenda item, which I jumped ahead of earlier. So this is agenda item number 9, and this is a division program updates. And it appears that we are going to initially hear from department staff Zach Mundy on both the for hire operating licensing program and the for hire vessel carrier insurance certificate program.
All right. Can you guys hear me okay?
Sure can.
All right. Excellent. Well, good morning, Chair Pierre, Commissioners, Deputy Director Fernandez, and Chief Deputy Director McGurk, as well as Senior Counsel Tobias. Appreciate you guys having us on. My name is Zach Mundy, and I manage the Division of Boating and Waterways Boating Safety Unit. I'll be presenting on the Division of Boating and Waterways for Hire Operator Program, as well as our for Hire Vessel Carrier Insurance Verification Program. I'll be referring to DBW as the division. DBW, the Division of Boating and Waterways, all of those. So my apologies for jumping around on that. A for-hire license is required by vessel operators who carry more than 3 passengers for compensation in non-navigable waters. Non-navigable waters being those that do not lead to the ocean. Typical for-hire license holders are held by individuals who operate vessels for fishing excursions, summer camps, tours, water taxis, water skiing services, and other related activities. Pictured here are applicants that are completing a DBW for-hire operator licensing examination in Big Bear, California. The examination is being administered by our DBW proctor, Doug Powell. Next slide, please. Listed here on this slide are the requirements to become a for-hire operator. In addition, the division has the discretion to waive these requirements when presented with a valid captain's license obtained through the U.S. Coast Guard. Pictured here is a DBW's contracted proctor again, retired Lieutenant Doug Powell, who holds a 100-ton captain's license through the United States Coast Guard, and he is testing at Bass Lake, performing a vessel safety inspection. Next slide, please. As of July 1st, 2026, we currently have approximately 343 operators licensed by the division. Pictured here is an on-the-water practical exam being administered at Bass Lake again, which is near Yosemite. Next slide, please. DBW is currently working with our Parks IT section in the testing phase of a web-based application system. This will streamline the process for the end user and staff when submitting and reviewing applications. Currently, applications must be submitted via email or mail, and DBW will have the ability to query information from this database as well. We're currently working on the development and testing phases right now of this new database. DBW is also working to establish a fee for the for-hire operator program pursuant to Assembly Bill AB-865, which requires this program to be cost neutral. DBW plans to consult with other for-hire businesses to help in creating a fee that allows this program to be cost neutral, but also allows the businesses to not sustain a financial hardship. Currently, this program is free. Pictured here is an on-the-water practical exam, again being administered at Bass Lake near Yosemite on a powered ski boat where the applicants are learning about proper carriage requirements. Next slide, please. This concludes my presentation on the for-hire operator program. I'll now go over our for-hire vessel carrier insurance verification program. Next slide, please. For-hire vessel carriers provide passenger transportation services for a fee, including activities like fishing charters, sightseeing tours, dinner cruises, so on and so forth. Under 759.2 of the Harbors and Navigation Code, every for-hire vessel company must obtain and register proof of sufficient insurance coverage. This insurance protects against liability and ensures compensation for damages, covering personal bodily injuries, including death, and property damage resulting from accidents during these services. Pictured here is a sunset sailing charter as well as a sport fishing charter. As of July 1st, 2026, there are 141 active for-hire vessel carrier companies registered. The Division of Boating and Waterways is ongoing in its effort to educate these companies, ensuring they achieve compliance with the state regulations. Certificates are good for one calendar year, and all applicants must renew at the time their insurance expires. The application fee is currently $25. This slide shows an example of a for-hire vessel insurance verification certificate. By law, the for-hire vessel operators must post the certificate in a prominent location on the vessel where it is clearly visible to all passengers. Next slide, please. The division currently operates the for-hire vessel carrier program under the California Public Utilities Commission general orders. DBW intends to establish modern program-specific regulations for the program within Title 14 of the California Code of Regulations, replacing the existing CPUC, or Public Utility Commission, standards with regulations developed under the division's own regulatory authority. The division continues to work diligently with commercial for-hire companies and commercial marine insurance companies to educate them on DBW's for-hire insurance requirements. DBW wants to strengthen its outreach and enforcement to inform for-hire vessel companies of program requirements while implementing robust enforcement measures to ensure compliance with the program. On this slide is San Francisco Bay Cruise, which is a company that is in compliance with the for-hire vessel carrier program. Next slide, please. This concludes my presentation, and I want to thank you guys for the opportunity to present on these programs, and I am available for any questions.
Madam Clerk, do we have any public comments on the item?
We have no green comment cards, and we have no hand raised online.
Okay, very well. Any of my fellow commissioners? Commissioner Gonzalez.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be quick. Thank you, Zach. One quick clarification confirmation question on the four higher operator licensing program. When you say there's approximately 343 operators, that means individuals, right? Like these are individuals that get that. It's not a entity or business or company, right?
It is. It could be either one. So the company, they are individuals, but so every company that has any company operating on inland waters must have the for hire operator certificate. Each one of them has to be licensed. So you can't just get one for the company. It has to be every, I don't want to say captain, but every operator has to have a license.
If it's an individual operating the craft, then that's who should
Correct.
Have a license.
Correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Commissioner Hallahan.
Hello. Thank you so much for your presentation. I spread the word to a lot of different mariners about what you do and have looked it up several times, and I just want to reiterate some of my understanding so we have it right.
Sure.
So inland waterways in San Francisco Bay is considered just through like the Oakland Bridge and up towards maybe the other side of San Pablo Bay? Like where does inland waterways start in San Francisco Bay?
The exact inland waterways are any waterways that are not navigable to the sea. So if it's navigable to the sea, a Coast Guard license would be required.
Okay. So in Stockton, you have to have a Coast Guard license if you're a vessel for hire.
Correct.
So that's the dividing line.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, great. So are people paying for vessel inspections or is that just being done for free?
Right now it's a free program. So they're not paying for the for hire operator or the proctor, which is why through AB 865 we're going to start. The law states that the program has to be cost neutral. And so that's where in my presentation I talked about we're convening groups of stakeholders to talk about kind of what that's going to look like. Right now, we don't have a lot of operators. I mean, well, we do, but for the cost of to operate the program, we want to make sure we do it in a way that not going to break these individuals also.
Just the reason that I ask is we don't in California have a sticker saying it's been an inspected vessel or anything like the U.S. Coast Guard has. We don't have that. You're just doing an inspected vessel that someone wants to do for hire on. Is that what's happening?
Well, sorry. Now I think I understand what you're asking. So there is a certificate that they're given, a license that they must have on there. So if they're stopped or if law enforcement stops them, they are required to show the license, the for hire operator license. They're given one for the office in the wall and they're given a pocket card license that explains everything that they are allowed to do. It also lists the water bodies that they are able to operate and qualified to operate on. And that's part of the exam and the proctoring process that Doug Powell, right now our contracted person, goes out and actually checks the vessels. They do the safety inspections on the vessels. He notes anything that must be corrected. That information comes back to us. Once everything is set and all is checked off, they've passed their practical exam and they've passed their written exam, then we get word back and we are able to make sure their paperwork is all in line and then issue the license.
I'm just asking if they're specifically licensed for that specific vessel, because the U.S. Coast Guard captain's license, you can be on any vessel.
It's vessel specific.
Yes, that is correct.
That's correct.
That's correct. It's just to that specific vessel. So yes. That's very interesting and really different than the U.S. Coast Guard. Just a shout out for the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary. They're all going up and down the state doing this for free a lot and giving stickers out to people. And we love seeing those stickers on boats when we're out on the water. So if a person has a U.S. Coast Guard captain's license, if they're going to be, say, on a lake and they're only having two or three people out on their boat, they would also have to have our state of California license as well if they are doing a charter.
Yeah. So the way that works is if they already have a U.S. Coast Guard license, they basically fill out the application, the first page, so I know who they are and their address, and they send me a copy of their U.S. Coast Guard license. I verify that through the U.S. Coast Guard. And if all of that is correct, then we issue them a license. But it's
not to a specific boat, or the boat also has to go through safety?
It's vessels up to a certain length.
I see. Okay.
A powered vessel up to a certain length. But if they have the U.S. Coast Guard, license, then we can basically waive a lot of the requirements for that, because they've already done the medical. They've already, yeah, you know, passed for that vessel. So
on your slide about insurance, you said 1,401, but the slide said 141. So is it that you have 1,401 that have gotten a certificate for insurance for carrying people, like when you showed the Golden Gate Bridge?
Let's see. I would have to see what slide you are talking about. It's 141 active for hire vessel carrier companies that we currently have registered.
So it is 141.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you're not counting ferries that are doing transportation. You're doing boats that have tours. Bigger boats with tours.
Correct. Ferries are through the California Public Utility Commission, and those are guided by the common carrier through CPUC, and they still have oversight over all carriers. So, no, it's as, and I'm sorry, I didn't see the 1,000, but it is 141 companies certified.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And so if a boat is already certified to be a ferry and they want to do a cruise, they would have to still go to this group and create another path, or are they okay to take a cruise out, like a sunset cruise, if they're already a transport ferry?
I'd actually have to look into. I have not come across that situation yet.
Just wondering, because we do that here, you know, because the Angel Island Ferry has a little, you know, thing that they do for transportation, and then they also do sunset cruise. I'm just interested because it seems like such a low number. But thank you so much for your work in making this available. I know there's a lot of details that you have to sort out all the time, and thanks for making the progress on it. Thank you.
No problem.
Anything further? No. I'll just point out that your this is me being a smart aleck. Your definition of navigable waterway is one that runs the ocean, but Lake Tahoe is considered a navigable waterway because it
you're right.
Breaches two state lines. And that's,
yes,
and that's why it's patrolled by the Coast Guard. All right. So that was me being a smart aleck.
Correct. No, you're right. And Lake Havasu and some of those are the same as well. They are under Coast Guard control. So, yeah. Thank you for that, Tom.
You got it. Okay. So now we're moving on to item number 9C, which is yacht and ship licensing. And I don't know. I don't have a notation of who is making that presentation. Is that you again, Zach, or?
That's me.
Chair Pierre, we have it noted that it will be department staff Monique Cabral and Lanchi Longell on the yacht and ship licensing program.
Okay, there they are. Okay, take it away.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. My name is Monique Cabral, and I am the licensing administrator for California Yacht and Ship Brokers and Salespersons. Today, I will provide an overview of the licensing section of the Yacht and Ship Program. Next slide, please. The Division of Boating Waterways, which I will refer to as the Division or DBW throughout this presentation, is responsible for licensing and regulating California yacht and ship brokers and salespersons under the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act. Anyone who sells used vessels that are 16 feet or longer and weigh less than 300 gross tons on behalf of others must be licensed by the division. The Yacht and Ship Program consists of two primary functions, licensing and enforcement. Next slide, please. A yacht broker is responsible for selling or offering to sell, purchasing or offering to purchase, soliciting or obtaining listings of, and negotiating the purchase, sale, or price of used vessels on behalf of others. This slide shows an image of an example of a yacht that is sold. Next slide, please. To be eligible to apply for a California yacht and shipbroker license, an applicant must be at least 18 years of age and qualify under one of the four statutory pathways. Have held a California yacht and shipbroker license within the past 5 years. Have been licensed as a California yacht and ship person salesperson for at least 1 year within the past 5 years. Have owned and operated a qualifying marine business in California for at least 3 continuous years, or have been employed as a yacht broker or salesperson in another state as their primary occupation for at least 3 continuous years immediately preceding application. In addition to meeting one of the statutory qualification pathways, every broker applicant must demonstrate the honesty, truthfulness, and good reputation required by the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act. To assist in making that determination, applicants must successfully complete both Department of Justice and FBI criminal history background checks. However, in October of 2025, the FBI suspended the division's authority to receive national criminal history information following an audit of the California Department of Justice, which found that DBW lacked explicit statutory authority to receive criminal history background information. DBW subsequently amended its statutory authority to address this issue and is currently awaiting FBI review and approval of the updated statute. That suspension remains in effect today. As a result, broker applications are currently limited to applicants who have previously held a California yacht broker or yacht salesperson's license because those applicants have already satisfied the FBI criminal history background check requirement. Applicants seeking to qualify through the California Marine Business Ownership and Operation Pathway or the out-of-state broker or salesperson experience pathway will again be eligible to apply once the division's authority to receive FBI criminal history information is restored. Next slide, please. The division issues 3 types of broker licenses: individual, partnership, and corporation. For a corporation to obtain a broker's license, it must be registered with the California Secretary of State and designate an individual who qualifies as the broker of record. This slide shows the image of a broker's license. Next slide, please. The current fees for an original broker's license are $200 for the license and $25 for the examination, for a total of $225. As of today, there are 289 active licensed yacht brokers in California. Next slide, please. I'll now turn to the second license type administered by the division, the yacht and ship salesperson's license. A yacht and ship salesperson is an individual who works under the supervision of a licensed California yacht broker. When hiring a salesperson, the broker and salesperson must enter into a broker-salesperson agreement that establishes the terms of their working relationship. California licensed brokers may not compensate anyone who is not licensed, who is not a licensed yacht broker or licensed yacht salesperson. However, a California licensed broker may pay a commission to a broker licensed in another state or country. Next slide, please. To qualify for the California Yacht and Ship Salesperson's License, an applicant must meet 3 requirements. First, be at least 18 years of age. Second, be sponsored by licensed California Yacht and Ship Broker. Third, demonstrate the honesty, truthfulness, and good reputation required by the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act. To assist in making that determination, applicants must successfully complete the Department of Justice and FBI criminal history background checks. As I mentioned previously, the division's authority to receive FBI criminal history information remains temporarily suspended pending FBI approval of the updated California law. Unlike the broker program, however, the division continues to accept new salesperson's license applications. Applicants who satisfy all other licensing requirements, including successful completion of the California Department of Justice life scan background check, may be issued a 60-day temporary salesperson's license while awaiting completion of the FBI criminal history background check. A permanent salesperson's license cannot be issued until the division's authority to receive FBI criminal history information is restored and the federal criminal history information has been received and reviewed. This slide shows an artist's renditions of a California Department of Justice emblem and of a salesperson's license displaying a photo of the license and a verification seal. Next slide, please. The total fee of an original salesperson's license is $150. This includes for the permanent license, the optional temporary license, and the examination fee. The slide also identifies the fees for license renewals, reinstatements, transfers, and other licensing services. As of today, there are 523 active permanent salesperson licenses and 16 active temporary salesperson's licenses. The number of temporary licenses fluctuates because they may be issued throughout the year and are only valid for 60 days from the date of issuance. An example of a temporary license is shown on this slide. Next slide, please. Both the broker and salesperson's applicants must pass the yachtship licensing examination before a license can be issued. The division administers examinations monthly in San Diego and every other month in Sacramento and Lake Paris. The examination consists of 100 multiple choice questions, and applicants must achieve a score of at least 70% to pass. The examination covers licensing laws, vessel operation and regulation, and vessel sales process, and the vessel sales process, excuse me. Applicants may take the examination up to 3 times. If an applicant does not pass after 3 attempts, they must wait 6 months before becoming eligible to retake the examination. This slide shows an image of the examination Scantron answer sheet. Next slide, please. As Deputy Director Fernandez stated earlier, Assembly Bill 865 requires the division to adopt regulations establishing the fees charged for examinations, licensing, license renewals, and other services provided under the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act. The legislation also requires those fees to be sufficient to recover the reasonable cost of administering the licensing program. To support the regulatory process, DBW convened 2 stakeholder meetings with representatives from the California Yacht Brokers Association, private brokers, and staff to gather input on the proposed fee adjustments. After evaluating several implementation options, including immediate implementation of all fee increases and phase-in periods ranging from 3 to 6 years, DBW selected a 4-year phase-in approach, with certain fees taking effect immediately, consistent with the stakeholders' recommendations. This approach achieves full cost recovery as required by statute while minimizing impacts to the industry. This slide shows an image of a cartoon illustration representing a legislative bill. This concludes my presentation on the licensing section of the Yacht and Ship Program. Next slide, please. I will now turn the presentation over to my colleague, Lanji Langell, who will present an overview of the enforcement section of the Yacht and Ship Program. Thank you.
All right. Good morning to all attendees. My name is Lanji Langell, and I am an enforcement analyst in DBW's Boating Safety Unit. I will be presenting on our Yacht and Ship Enforcement Program. DBW enforces Harbors and Navigation Code Article 2, Yacht and Ship Brokers Section 700 to 740. Our enforcement section of the Yacht and Ship Program regulates the activities of licensees and monitors activities for which a yacht and ship license is required, to ensure regulatory compliance, and to provide consumer protection. Photographed on this slide are one of the many marinas with vessels in the state of California of which these enforcement investigations may take place. Next slide, please. The enforcement side of the Yacht and Ship Program operates under 3 components. The first component is ensuring regulatory compliance of yacht and ship licensees. The next component is investigating consumer complaints against yacht and ship licensees. And the third component in this enforcement program is monitoring for and responding to any unlicensed activity. Next slide, please. DBW ensures regulatory compliance primarily by conducting inspections. During an inspection, the division inspects records to verify that transactions are in compliance with the harbor and navigation codes. We conduct physical inspections of brokerage operations or, in rare cases, remote audits of brokerage files. During an inspection, we verify the licensing status for the brokerage, any additional branch licenses, and all salespersons who are licensed under the broker's license. We review the broker and salesperson agreements within the brokerage, inspect listing agreements, purchase agreements, and other financial documents for compliance with the requirements set forth in the Harbor and Navigation Code, confirm advertised vessel information with the records in the brokerage, and provide real-time education, support, and response to all inquiries. Next slide, please. The second component of the enforcement section is investigating consumer complaints. Once a complaint is verified to fall within DBW's jurisdiction, DBW has a legislative mandate to investigate all complaints. These complaints can range from dissatisfaction with representation by a broker to allegations of fraud. The division does not have jurisdiction over new boat sales or used boat sales that were not brokered. An example of a transaction that does not fall under DBW's authority would be if an individual were selling a boat they own through a classified ad. For complaints, we first conduct a preliminary investigation to confirm jurisdiction. Next, we gather information and evidence from both complainant and the respondent. We then complete a desk investigation where we review the complaint and all information and documentation received, and we complete additional research if needed. If necessary, interviews are conducted with the complainant, the respondent, and any witnesses, if available. And once the investigation is complete, the division identifies what, if any, violations of the harbors and navigation codes occurred and determines the level of intervention required, which I will cover in a moment. Next slide, please. The third component of the enforcement section is monitoring and responding to unlicensed activity. The division receives tips from licensees and consumers regarding the licensing of brokers and salespeople, as well as potential unlicensed activity. DBW also consistently monitors online advertisements for licensing compliance. We conduct investigations into possible unlicensed activity and document any evidence. And if any unlicensed activity is found, we make notifications to the appropriate entities. For example, a broker will be notified if their salespersons are advertising vessels for sale while their license is in a suspended status, or if they're advertising vessels for sale without identifying the brokerage who holds the listing. An out-of-state company will be notified if they are advertising California vessels for sale. Out-of-state brokers are sent a cease and desist letter and education on the harbors and navigation codes. And an unlicensed individual is provided with education and information on how to become licensed. DBW follows up as needed with any individuals or companies who are found to not be in compliance with the harbor and navigation codes. Next slide, please. DBW enforces the harbor and navigation codes through three main levels of intervention. The level of intervention depends on multiple factors, including the type of violation, the seriousness of the violation, if it is a repeat offender, the involved party's knowledge of the harbors and navigation codes, etc. We educate, which would be the first level of intervention, by providing information while responding to any stakeholder questions. We can also use corrective guidance, which can include informative letters, warning letters, or cease and desist notices. Second, we can increase the level of intervention pursuant to the Harbors and Navigation Code, Section 739, by assessing civil penalties based on the violations identified during an inspection or complaint investigation. And third, our strongest level of intervention involves referring a case or a penalty matter to the Attorney General's office to be heard by an administrative law judge who can decide the matter and or order additional discipline or penalties, including but not limited to revoking a broker or salesperson's license. Next slide, please. Listed on this slide is the contact information for the Yacht and Ship Program. Thank you for allowing me to present on the enforcement section. This concludes my presentation.
Madam Clerk, pardon me. Do we have any public comment on a matter?
Chair Pierre, we have no green comment cards and we have no hands raised online.
Okay, very well. Anything from my fellow commissioners? Please.
I'll go first and super quickly. Another confirmation clarification question. Longi, this is for you. Thank you for whatever you presented. So when you're talking about like your levels of intervention or, you know, receiving the complaint, and if let's say education is a level of intervention, is that you or someone in your role that is doing that work? Or I'm guessing it goes to a staff member that then says, this is what we work on up until it has to be referred out.
Yes, I can confirm that would be the duty of my role.
Awesome. Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes, Commissioner Hallihan.
Hi, thank you all for a great presentation. This is very complex, so I just want to make sure I'm understanding. If someone, I'm just going to give a hypothetical, is brokering a deal and they're saying that they're a nonprofit, kind of like how people do car donations to get big tax write-offs. And then, you know, basically someone sells the car and there's not taxes paid or there's income tax violations. Do we do any looking into that type of, I know that the state has changed up their laws about what that looks like when someone donates a boat. I know that Cal Poly had some boats donated and they had to keep them for 3 years in the service of the Cal Poly before they could release or sell it. And someone got a tax write-off and that was done appropriately. Are we also reviewing that type of activity?
Long, do you want me to take this?
Yeah.
Am I still on? Okay. So we have had this. Thank you, Maggie. We've had this come up. And it really is, like you said, it's complicated. Each one is really different. We've had auction houses that will sell a boat on behalf of somebody. In that respect, they are required to be a broker themselves and have a broker's license to do that. If it's a donation where, for instance, whoever is taking the donation, if it goes into their ownership, If they take ownership of the title and everything, they can sell it. They're selling their own vessel. If they try to sell something that is owned by somebody else, it really comes down to if somebody else owns the vessel and somebody is selling it for them, they're required to have a broker's license. So that's a very easy way of saying addressing that question right there. If there's specific nuances, I would request have you know, if there's certain questions on that, have them reach out to Longi so we can really look into the details of the specific deal.
So if someone is brokering it and they set up set it up as a lease, like they accept it as a donation and then they lease it to another entity for 3 years, then that would be probably acceptable. I'm going to send you some reference cases and see what you think about it. I'd be interested to see how the shakedown is on that.
Yeah.
All right. Because
we attend the legal seminars as well. And we do have a guy that does have a situation like that. So, but they never retain ownership. So there is stuff in there, but we'll look forward to receiving that and look through those for you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Anyone else? Nothing heard. I was trying to keep a running tally of all these various licenses and insurance certificates and things like that. Who collects? I mean, I sort of came up roughly with like $1.5 million in fees for all these various programs. Who collects that? Does DBW collect the funds? I mean, who does someone write a check to?
So that would be, so as far as my programs are concerned, those are the ones that I can speak to, but they come into state parks, California state parks, checks are written to that, and then they have a specific code to goes into these particular programs. So for instance, yacht and ship funds that come in for fees come in through the yacht and ship and they go into the yacht and ship account. So they are earmarked for the specific funds that they are. The insurance verification certificate program is the same way.
They go into the Harbors and Watercraft revolving fund.
That's what I was driving at. Okay, great. Nope. Okay, thank you. Okay, so on that note, let's move on to the next item. Thank you very much, all of you, which is item number 9D, Aquatic Center Grant Program. And who's going to make that presentation?
We have Anna Prinzbach, and she will be speaking regarding the Aquatic Center Grant Program.
Thank you. Welcome, Anna.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Anna Prinzbach. I'm the new program lead for the Division of Boating and Waterways, or DBW, Aquatic Center Grants Program. Amy Rigby has retired. So to start this presentation about Aquatic Center Grant Program, shown on this slide is an example of one of our grantees' classes of students on their kayaks. Next slide, please. This is a federal pass-through grant. DBW receives funding for this program from the Federal Sport Fish Restoration and Boating Trust Fund. The funding is administered by the U.S. Coast Guard through the Recreational Boating Safety Grant. DBW is required to follow federal and Coast Guard goals when granting these funds to aquatic centers. The program goal, as set by the Coast Guard, is to reduce boating injuries and fatalities. Courses emphasize rules of the road, on-the-water skills development, and the proper use of safety equipment. DBW allocates funding for the Aquatic Center Grant Program to increase boater safety through education. Additionally, DBW asks applicants to identify boating accidents and safety issues in their area and demonstrate how their courses are designed to reduce those specific issues. Now, shown in this slide are some young students sitting together in a boating class. Next slide, please. For who can apply, program funding is designed to augment, not fully support, successful Aquatic Center programs. Eligible applicants must be one of the following: a college or university, a public agency, or a nonprofit organization with 501c3 status. An agency must do the following things to be eligible for funding. Agencies must have an existing boating safety education program. They need to provide on-the-water boating safety education. They need to teach boating safety skills, particularly how to safely operate a boat in the waterways and in conditions students are likely to experience in their region. And they must require that life jackets be worn when on or near the water at their center. Shown in this slide is a woman water skiing. Next slide, please. Just to add a little bit more regarding eligibility, I want to emphasize that many programs that we fund have small footprints. They might rent a space from other entities or be completely mobile, operating out of trailers or shipping containers. A program does not need to have an actual facility to receive funding. This slide shows the Tahoe City Public Utility District Program. This program rents a space from a local marina and then assembles their modular dock for the season, which is shown in these pictures. When the season ends, the dock is then disassembled and stored in a container along with their boats at a different location. In addition to items such as boats, trailers, and engines, these grants can fund modular docking, mooring buoys, and storage containers, all of which will allow an on-the-water program to be effective even with limited space and funding. Next slide, please. Education courses for any activity that meet the definition of recreational boating can qualify for funding. However, the priorities are to educate students so they can safely boat independently by the end of each course. The following types of on-the-water activities are typical. There's paddling, which would include whitewater rafting, canoeing, kayaking, and stand-up paddleboard, and beginning rowing when life jackets are worn. There's power boating, which would include open motorboat, tow sports, and personal watercraft. And sailing, which would include windsurfing, sailing, and kite surfing. Now, applicants can apply for funding in four categories. The first category is equipment related to teaching on-the-water courses for students and instructors. Eligible equipment purchases include boats, such as paddlecraft, sailboats, and safety boats. There's engines, trailers, and non-permanent storage and docking. And boat parts, such as sails, and other boating safety-related supplies like life jackets and wetsuits. Another category is scholarships. Applicants can apply for scholarship funding to be used by participants for their on-the-water boating education courses. Grant funding can also be used for transportation costs to get participants to the program site for these courses. Instructor training is another category. Grant funding can be used for program instructors to complete boating safety instruction trainings. Lastly is boating events. Applicants may request an additional $2,000 each year to offset the cost of boating safety events for the general public. Often these events will coincide with National Safe Boating Week in May, but some might coincide with an Aquatic Center's opening day or another local event. Now seen in this slide is a class sailing out on the water. Next slide, please. For funding and use restrictions, this program does not provide funding for permanent structures. But as mentioned previously, items such as movable storage sheds or modular removable docking and other items such as Moby mats that will help transport equipment or wheelchairs across the sand can be purchased with the grant. Additionally, per the Coast Guard, the use of equipment for competition is limited to 10% of overall program use, and the use of equipment for rentals is limited to 40% of overall program use. Shown in the slide are some examples. In the upper left corner is a person using a beach wheelchair. You can see all people can access and enjoy boating. In the lower left corner is a portable Moby boat ramp. In the upper right corner is a movable storage container for boating equipment. And in the lower right corner is a modular dock. Next slide, please. The amount available to award each year can vary depending on the amount of federal funding received. In the last year funding cycle for fiscal year 25 to 26, DBW was allocated $1.3 million in funding to award. DBW received requests for for $1.9 million in funding from 49 applicants, and we awarded the entire $1.3 million to 41 applicants. In this upcoming grant cycle, we have approximately $1.4 million to award. In looking at the award size, the average award in 2025 was $32,000. Applicants who serve less than 1,200 students annually were eligible for up to $42,000 in funding, and applicants who served 1,200 or more students annually were eligible for up to $62,000 in funding. For students served in 2025, 67,794 people were trained in boating safety across the state with programming, scholarships, and equipment DBW funded through this program. 38% of students that took boating safety courses at centers were from underserved areas or populations. Now seen in the slide are students participating in whitewater rafting. Next slide, please. Grantees offer boating safety events throughout the year which go beyond classes. These events are advertised and open to the general public, and they generally take place on their aquatic center or other programming locations. They offer on-the-water boating safety experiences. They offer life jacket trade-ins, giveaways, and fitting demonstrations, and they offer boating safety literature, boater card information, and mussel information. Many of these events occur during National Safe Boating Week in May, but many are also in coordination with other local events. Some events are held in off-water locations, such as on-campus orientations, or other community events, which will allow them to reach additional audiences. Some examples are shown in the slide. At the top is a picture of family night, where parents come to a one evening of a week-long summer camp, and their kids get to show them what they've learned by taking their parents out on boats. On the bottom left is a build-a-boat activity. This is one of the events offered by the Dana Point Youth Foundation. People often unexpectedly find themselves learning about buoyancy, the importance of life jackets, and having to paddle their self-constructed boats. And in the lower right corner is the City of Reading's Halloween event. Participants will paddle kayaks through an on-the-water haunted house in their pool, and this will allow the city to promote not only life jacket safety and other water safety messages, but also to advertise their ongoing camps and classes to a wider audience that are in need of safety education. Next slide, please. Our grantees also coordinate with other DBW programs and often use DBW-created boating safety materials. One example is the popular DBW publication in the AquaSmart series. Students complete the workbook and learn lessons such as how to float and how to properly fit and wear a life jacket, as seen in these slides. Next slide, please. Grantees will help DBW promote safety messages for our multimedia campaign at their events. Here you can see the boater card and the Live to Ride life jacket message being promoted at an event. Next slide, please. Grantees assist DBW with clean and green activities and teach students how to reduce boater impacts on the environment. On Coastal Cleanup Day 2025, 12 aquatic centers participated with over 3,000 people attending. The aquatic centers removed 47,000 pounds of trash and 298 pounds of recyclables. As seen in this slide, on the left is a group collecting trash along the water, and on the right are three participants showing off how much trash they collected. Next slide, please. Now, what do these photos have in common? None of these people expected to become boaters. In the top left is a paraplegic using a rolling dock, making it much easier for him to get on the water. In the top right is a group of former gang members from Homeboy Industries who never thought they would be sailing. In the bottom left are two families that were randomly assigned to the same boat in an introductory sailing class that they were expecting to be a one-time experience. Now these girls are best friends who continue to boat regularly. In the bottom center are participants in a boating class targeted at seniors. Many think that they are too old or they lack the strength to learn the kayak, which is not the case. And in the bottom right are teenagers learning to get to their aquatic center by bus and BART so they can see how easy it is to come regularly. Next slide, please. For some upcoming highlights, the application for fiscal year 26 to 27 funding will be opening in mid-September. This year's Aquatic Center Directors' meetings date and location are still being decided on, but the meetings are open to the public and potential grantees are encouraged to attend. These meetings are a great way for Aquatic Center staff to receive information and assistance from DBW and to network with each other, exploring new ideas and solutions for unique challenges. Here in the slide is showing a class of students that are out sailing. Next slide, please. So this concludes my presentation. If you have any questions at this time, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Madam Clerk, do we have any public comment on the matter?
We have no green comment cards and we see no hands raised online.
Okay, I'll close public comments on this. Do any of my fellow commissioners have? Okay, look at some hands. Perfect. Okay. Commissioner Idsater.
Thank you, Anna, for that excellent presentation. Great job. A question I had for you was what follow-up work do you do or does the department do to make sure that the funding provided is put to the right uses and that these centers are well utilized, right? I know utilization rates can vary rather substantially if you look at different aquatic centers across our state. And I've seen it as I've been out there engaging with some of them. Because I'm really appreciative of the work that you do and that the staff at these aquatic centers do. I think it's really important to the future of boating in our state. But I was curious what procedures are in place for following up and assessing, evaluating that the funding is being put to good use.
I'll say, speaking, I know a little bit in regards to this, I would say, is one when they're actually doing the applications, not quite following up, but they do list the courses that they're offering and specifically what they're requesting and how it then relates to the classes that they're offering. Additionally, when they're doing, for example, like their reimbursement claims, when they're sending, for example, for scholarships, they list a roster with students and their contact information who took the class. I am then able to audit so I can contact the participants to make sure things like that are happening. I don't know if that answers your question. I also might defer to my supervisor, Deborah Holmes or Karen, because they might know a bit more about this since I haven't done a full cycle yet.
Okay, thank you. It looks like Karen may want to address or Karen Holmes will want to address us next.
Hi, yes, Deborah Holmes. I'm a manager with the Division of Boating and Waterways. And Anna's correct in we have a few different methods that we use to ensure that the funds are being spent as intended. And one is what they submit in their application as far as their course curriculums, but also, like she mentioned, the reimbursement claims, we monitor how they're spending the funds. So we can see from there that the funds are being used appropriately. And then lastly, one thing that Anna has not experienced with this yet, which will be coming up, is they submit an annual report. So every year in December, every center that receives this grant funding submits a report to us with the statistics of who they served and what courses the students participated in. So that's pretty much our monitoring. And we do conduct site visits a few times a year, and we just check their inventory, make sure that the equipment's there and that it's in good condition. And then we also observe programming.
Thank you, Deborah. Very helpful.
Okay, and I think I saw Commissioner Gonzalez had a question.
Yes, thank you. And I'll throw some questions to you, Anna, and of course, welcome to the division. And
thank you.
Trust you to delegate to others on staff if it's too new of a question. First, on what I wanted to know, as a reminder, when it's the kind of eligibility and program stipulations. It has to be an existing program, correct? In other words, like the funds cannot be used to initiate or pilot a new program. If an applicant wanted to do that, they would have to have separate funding sources for that. And then once they're able to get that up and going, they could apply for this grant, correct?
That is correct. Yes, they need an existing program.
All right. And then on kind of the eligible for the funding categories, as you mentioned, they could buy equipment for it, so as long as it's going for the, you know, on the water programming. Is it can applicants request specific for one thing? Is there any requirements for a mix? Like if someone just wants equipment, or if someone just wants to do scholarships, that's all eligible, right?
Yes, yeah. So they can decide when they're doing the application, they put in for what it is they need. So yeah, some they may just be putting in for scholarships for students. Others, they may need to be replacing a lot of equipment for that season. So they're putting in for specific equipment items, and they can list what those equipment pieces are.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question, I think I've asked this before, and I'm curious, not looking for specific numbers if not available, rough percentage estimate. I think in terms of applicants here, they're roughly broken down into college and universities, local public agencies, and then kind of other 501c3 nonprofit orgs, I'm guessing like community-based orgs. Do you have an idea of, I know for the 2025-26, it says a total of 41 grantees. Are they predominantly kind of colleges or universities? Are they, you know, what's, I'm just curious roughly what the mix is of all those three.
Absolutely. So for a general breakdown, I would say I would estimate that there's roughly 50% is going to be close to nonprofit. And then universities are going to be roughly 35%. I'll say if you want more exact numbers, I can absolutely get that back to you, excuse me. But that would be off the top of my head, my best estimation.
And so the lowest amount would be like other local public agencies?
Yeah, like cities around 15% would be my guess, or my estimation, excuse me.
Okay, thank you so much.
Any other questions from my fellow commissioners? Okay. Nothing heard. We thank you very much for the presentation. For your first time out of the blocks, I think that was exceptional. So
thank
welcome
you.
Aboard. And I don't know when we'll see you next, but thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that terminates item 9D. And now we move on to, we're 8 minutes ahead, administrative items. And so just as a reminder, and I think someone mentioned it earlier, that the next commission tour and meeting, well, not tour, just meeting, will take place in Newport Beach, where I used to be a lifeguard, in conjunction with the Marine Recreation Association annual conference, at which I will be speaking, both of course, held in Newport Beach for, again, our quarter four of 2026 meeting. I think I mentioned November 3. Also at that meeting, we are going to have the election of the commission chair and vice chair. I don't know if that I've formally asked you guys, Commissioner Hallahan and Commissioner Idsater, to serve on the nomination committee. But I believe informally you both agreed to do that. Okay. And does that comport with the understanding of council? Okay. Okay. Well, now we go to item number 11, which is suggested agenda items for our November 3 meeting. Does anyone have any suggested agenda items? Please.
Before we do that, Chair Pierre, I have a brief update on the work of the Subcommittee on Boat Slips that I would like to deliver here as part of this meeting. That's something that was agreed on in our last meeting.
Okay, and I just did not make this agenda.
Okay.
I'm concerned that if it's not properly agendized for public consumption, I don't, I'll defer to counsel on this.
Did you have a section on? I think that could come under Commissioner Activities Update. But usually, we should have a section on here on Commissioner on Subcommittee Reports.
Yeah.
So,
Well, that's kind of where I was going with Commissioner Hallahan, as if how sort of where those lines become blurred about commissioners' reports and so forth. Is this just an administrative oversight that what Commissioner Ipstadter wants to present on now, that it did not make the printed agenda?
I don't see anything I don't see an agenda item for subcommittee reports, and we should have had one on those. So I would say, in the interest of getting it sounds like he thought this was going to be on. I don't think it's going to hurt to have that report,
Okay.
but we should have had a section on that.
Please.
Thank you, legal counsel Tobias, and thank you, Chair Pierre. I wanted to provide an update on the work of the Subcommittee on Boat Slips, Moorings, and Related Amenities in the state of California. As you will recall, we formulated three hypotheses at our meeting held in Long Beach in conjunction with the last MRA conference. And in our report dated November 3rd, 2025, you can see those three hypotheses, which I will not take time here rereading. What I would like to report is that since then, we have conducted extensive additional research to validate or falsify each one of those hypotheses. As part of these validation efforts, we have interviewed numerous boaters and other boating-related stakeholders across the state of California. Our objective, as you'll remember from our last meeting, is to deliver our final report before the end of this year, ideally at our next meeting in Newport Beach. For now, I would just like to share with you the following interim progress report for your consideration. First of all, and most importantly, we are pleased to report that in general, our three hypotheses stand. We have not found any compelling reasons based on all the work we've been doing, Commissioner Hallahan and I, to reject any one of the three hypotheses. However, as often happens when you conduct detailed outreach and research, there is a lot more nuance than the subcommittee had initially anticipated. So I'd like to share some of these findings here with you now, and I think they may, depending on what we find in the months ahead, necessitate certain modifications to our original hypothesis before we deliver our final report. So, not to get too academic about it, I'd like to share just very clear bullet point findings with you that are very much real world findings. Our first finding is that while it is generally true that boats up to 30 feet in length can be stored on trailers in residential locations, the practical implications of doing so may be prohibitive in some cases. One example involves the owner of a 30-foot sailboat, whom I spoke with, who lives in a dense urban area without access to a backyard or a driveway in which to store a trailer with his sailboat on top. Another example involves the owner of a 23-foot electric wakeboat who wants her boat professionally stored within proximity of charging infrastructure. And that is not something that allows for her to just store it on a driveway. And she also happens to live in an urban location. So we believe that these kinds of barriers, which we had not previously considered in our analysis, they merit further analysis of other potential storage options, such as dry stacks, for example, which you can have in proximity to wet storage and charging infrastructure at some of the existing recreational harbors out there. Our second new finding is that although occupancy rates for slips in the size range of 45 feet and larger are generally very healthy, there are some occasional vacancies, and there's actually some weakness from time to time, even among the larger slips. So for example, right now, marina operators and recreational harbor masters in the Los Angeles area are reporting significant vacancies for 60-foot slips specifically, which is something we're trying to understand. And of course, it's important to identify whether or not that is just a cyclical trend or if there could be something structural at play, in which case we would have to modify our original hypothesis. The third finding I'd like to share with you is that promoting awareness of the mental health benefits of boating and contact with our waterways, including the concept of blue mind, is becoming ever more important, and it's actually there's even a greater appetite and demand out there for a focus on that than what we had initially thought when we started our work. You've probably all seen reports that indicate that possibly as many as half of our youth are struggling with anxiety and depression disorders, and the well-documented linkages between those observations and the amount of time spent on screens, and not to mention social media and now the AI-powered apps out there. And the fact that getting youth and just people in general out on the water helps to reset the nervous system and mitigate a lot of the negative effects of digital technology, we think is particularly relevant here in the state of California, which is also the origin of a lot of that technology. So we intend to make this an even greater focus of our work in the months ahead. I would also add that activities like stand-up paddleboarding and kayaking keep making great progress across our state. There are people out there who claim that the stand-up paddleboard is now the single most popular piece of sporting equipment in the nation, at least in the state of California. I have not been able to validate that, but there are claims like that out there, which I think is great because we believe that activities like stand-up paddleboarding and kayaking are critical to the future of boating and the boater population in California. And it's been particularly encouraging to hear these reactions, since a lot of the work that we do here with the commission of funding public launch ramps for non-motorized vessels is, of course, the critical foundation needed for more people to be able to experience these wonderful activities. And I have myself been out there on a stand-up paddleboard recently, as well as a kayak. And it really is amazing to see how you've got people of all ages, right? And thinking back to the presentation we just heard on aquatic centers, being out there together on the water and just being completely detached from the digital world in which we spend such a large portion of our lives these days. So we also want to make that a larger focus of our work in the months ahead. And then lastly, we have identified not only boat rentals and boat clubs, but also boat charters and boat sharing apps as very important rungs along the boating ladder or the pathway into boating, if you will, as boaters want to find other types of boating. Once they've developed an interest in boating, these are some of the very important types of boating and services out there that we'd also like to spend more time analyzing. So thank you for your opportunity to provide this interim progress report. We look forward to completing the work of the subcommittee on boat slips in the months ahead, and subsequently advising the Division of Boating and Waterways on what concrete actions can be taken in response to the issues identified.
So let me ask you this. Well, first of all, thank you guys for doing a tremendous amount of work, and it's much appreciated. Let me ask you guys, do you want to place this on the formal agenda item for the next meeting?
Yes, I think we should. Yes, we both agree on that.
Okay, so that's so recommended, and if we can just make sure it's on for December 3, and that'll be the formal presentation instead of the interim presentation. So all of that said, any other potential agenda items? Yes, please.
Thank you.
Commissioner Medina.
Thank you to Commissioner Itzader and Commissioner Hallahan on your work, and particularly with respect to point number three, with respect to the Blue Mine. I know the Long Beach LA region has been instrumental in kind of develop the development of the blue economy, but I love the idea of the Blue Mine and how important it is for our youth. So great work, and I look forward to hearing the final report at the next meeting. With that said, Chair, I know I made a recommendation earlier to kind of hear FTE numbers for DBW and just to get a total count on their titles and responsibilities, duties for DBW. I wonder if for the next agenda, for the next meeting, we could have a small report just on the number of DBW staff, duties and responsibilities, and their alignment with the Harbors and Nav Code story report, if that's possible.
It's possible. Noted.
Thank you.
Okay, good. So that'll be agendized as well. And did I see a nice another hand, Commissioner Hallahan?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everyone. In our research, one of the things this accident that happened 2 weeks ago, there were a lot of media out, people doing a lot of press. And the two things that came up talking to media people that are out there doing all the urban media that happens in a dense populated area like this, I learned two things. One is that generationally, if people didn't have their parents on the water or have access to the water, and they never got on the water, even though San Francisco is a peninsula and they're surrounded by the water, they have given up, completely given up that they will ever be on the water. So they see boats. And in our research that we did, we also prepared California boating cards by zip codes. And we're right now in a marina that was built with lots of housing on the side. But in our zip code research, it's 0.0001. It's the lowest. It's basically no one in this area where we're at has boating cards. Where the Marina District, if we took a view, they have boating cards in that area because it grew up, that community grew up getting on the water. So one of the national networks and the local papers, a lot of the times they're going up to their higher level people, and they're not doing stories on the good things that are happening on the water because people have given up. It's just for rich people. And this is not true in what we're finding in our research and what we're finding in registered vessels. Registered vessels are really around 20 to 25 feet, and they're in remote areas in the state, and that seems to be intergenerational, where someone has a fishing boat and that type of thing. So we may be including in details of when we were talking about the blue therapy about what is it to give up on being on the water, even when you're surrounded. That's an emotional energy, and that's what our kids are dealing with, is giving up and just looking at screens. So whatever, you know, we can do to try to bring this knowledge base together with how we see boating cards in zip codes and boat registration zip codes, and, you know, seeing what cities and counties are doing good, you know, the ones that are promoting it in their own area, because it really is up to the city and counties a lot of times because they're managing the property. So thank you. We'd like to add that into it as well.
Okay. So that'll be folded into the agenda item in the into the presentation of the report, right? Because that's... Yeah, please.
No, I just wanted to add to that, that it's interesting once you break down the types of boating in California or nationwide for that matter, to see what a small part yachting accounts for. Yet in the public imagination, right, especially among non-boaters, there can be this association between boating as an activity and wealth, high incomes, right? And that is something we'd like to address, because the vast majority of boat slips in California are not large slips. The vast majority of boats are not yachts. And the vast majority of boaters are not necessarily in those categories of high wealth, high income. Again, everything's a matter of definition, right? But this is something that we have encountered perhaps even more than anticipated. You know, the attitudes of boating is only for the wealthy few. And also another attitude, which is that boating is inherently dangerous, which I think speaks to another very important mission of our commission, which is addressing boater safety and boater education. So just wanted to make sure everyone's aware of that, and we will certainly be keeping those aspects in mind as we continue our work in the months ahead.
Thank you so much for everything the division does. It's really important to keep, you know, that knowledge base out there for people so they can feel encouraged to do this activity. Thank you.
I don't know who to, pardon me, who on staff to address this to. Is the request for proposal for the boating economy, is that going to be ready? Are you going to issue an RFP prior to November 3? I'm trying to get at is, should we have an agenda item for that, so the commission can be advised and appraised of what the division is looking to accomplish with the economic impact?
I'm not sure on that timeline, but when we meet on our in-between, I'll make sure that we connect on that topic, whether we add it or not, on the timing of the RFP, because it is a lengthy process.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So let's, if I may suggest, can we just agendize that, and then we can always strike it if it's not available by November 3. Okay, so we'll do that. So that's another agenda item. Okay, great. Anything else? Okay, very well. With that, I will formally adjourn the meeting.